Welcome to Politics Done Right. I am your host, Egberto Willis. This is a progressive program that will take the mystery out of politics. This is the program that will encourage you to make sure government becomes we the people. Whether you are liberal, progressive, conservative, or otherwise, you get to hear your point of view. We are an independent media outlet that, unlike mainstream media beholden to corporations, we only owe allegiance to you. Remember, you can also send me a tweet at EGBERTOWILLIES. That is at Egberto Willis. Let us engage. It is Politics Done Right. Welcome to Politics Done Right from the studios of KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, your community radio station. We have a great program for you today.
I think you guys are going to love this. We have the author of Clash, John Marshall. We are going to really discuss that, what we have.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Have with respect to the media, I challenged him about many things that the media, I think, get wrong. We had a very healthy discussion that we play that at the end of the program today. I think you guys are going to love it. But anyhow, we're going to discuss much of what is happening in Uvalde. I mean, that still hurts to the core. I sit back and wonder how these people do what they do. But you know what they say? Let's get busy. The NRA would love to let you believe that they are in support of the Second Amendment and they're there to protect the rights of those good red-blooded real Americans, right? That's what they like to preach. They always do that. But why do we believe it? LaPierre, their CEO, he spends their money like it's his own. But not only like it's his own, it's like it's money falling from a tree. But you know what? What they think about their own members, it is astounding. Check this out, and then we'll take it on the other side, because you'd not believe what they actually think about their guys. Check it out.
It was 11 days after the shooting at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, that killed 13 people. Five students were still hospitalized, but the NRA's big annual meeting that year had already been planned. It was set to take place in Denver, about a half an hour drive from where the shooting took place. And the NRA decided the show must go on. 8,000 people protested outside the NRA meeting in Denver that year. Tomorrow, the NRA is holding its annual meeting in Houston, just 3 days after the mass shooting here in Uvalde, Texas. President Trump and Texas Senator Ted Cruz are all scheduled to speak, but the loudest voices at the meeting might be outside of it. Protests of the events are being planned. Now, it's shocking to learn that the NRA has had two annual meetings this close in both time and proximity to major mass shootings, but it makes sense. Their meeting is annual. The shootings are far too common. But that isn't why I wanted to direct your attention back to that NRA convention in Denver in 1999. It's worth focusing on that convention because of some incredible audio that NPR unearthed last year, giving us a window into what the NRA, which is ostensibly a member-led and democratic organization, thinks about its own members. This audio is of the leaders of the NRA debating whether to still have their annual convention after the the Columbine shooting. They ultimately decided they would scale it down, remove the exhibit halls that could lead to pictures being taken of kids holding guns and other bad optics, and just have the speeches and the members meeting. This is one of the key lobbyists for the NRA at the time, talking about why scaling back might be a problem for them.
If you pull down the exhibit hall, that's not going to leave anything for the media except the members meeting. And you're going to have the wackos with all kinds of crazy resolutions, with all kinds of dressing like a bunch of hillbillies and idiots. And it's going to be the worst thing you can imagine.
That's right. The worst thing this lobbyist from the NRA can imagine is what he called the NRA's own hillbilly idiot members. The NRA hasn't had an annual meeting for the past 2 years because of COVID, but its last meeting was in 2019. It was consumed by infighting. The president of the organization was forced out by its board. Its longtime CEO, Wayne LaPierre, was nearly ousted by a vote of no confidence. The source of the drama? Well, if you were an NRA member in that year preceding the convention, you might have noticed that their fundraising efforts were becoming more and more desperate. This is an email to members from CEO Wayne LaPierre. Quote, "The Second Amendment cannot survive without the NRA, and the NRA cannot survive without your help right now." But at the same time, the NRA had reduced spending on its avowed core mission, gun education, safety, and training, to less than 10% of its total budget, and public reporting was showing all sorts of fun ways that money was being spent instead. $39,000 for one day of shopping in Beverly Hills for the CEO, Wayne LaPierre. $200,000 for air transportation for a two-week trip to the Bahamas over Christmas for the CEO, Wayne LaPierre. And this one never ended up materializing, but the Wall Street Journal got its hands on documents confirming that the NRA was going to buy a $6 million mansion for Wayne LaPierre. And that's just Wayne LaPierre. It turns out lots of board members are being heavily assisted by their member donation piggy bank. Remarkably, Wayne LaPierre is still the NRA's CEO. He will be at the event in Houston tomorrow. And while the organization may tout itself as one designed to defend the Second Amendment's rights of its members, the facts tell a different story. In the wake of Sandy Hook, the Violence Policy Center discovered that the gun industry donated tens of millions of dollars to the NRA, with nearly two dozen gun makers lining the organization's coffers. And while the NRA is only spending 10% of its money on its actual core mission, and then a little on top of that for Wayne LaPierre's lavish lifestyle, the one thing it is serious about and does spend big money on is its messaging. Messaging that helps gun manufacturers keep selling more guns. So when you see images coming out of the NRA meeting tomorrow, video of crowds of people cheering on Donald Trump and Wayne LaPierre, remember that. The NRA uses its members to get what its leaders and the gun lobby wants, not the other way around.
Now, is that interesting or what? It is amazing. It is just amazing what they think about their own. And to think that these people continue to send them money, send them cash, folks, let your fellow NRA members see this video. Let them see how their group actually thinks about them. It's never about the Second Amendment. As they get harmed, as they populate and fill the coffers of the gun companies are just giving their money to the NRA to keep misleading you, misinforming you, so you'll continue to buy their crap. And in the process, a lot of Americans get killed. As you guys know, Corinne Jean-Pierre, she's an immigrant from Asian relatives, family. She's also a LGBTQ person. And you can see how our system tries to discredit the other. And sometimes it is done in very, very subtle ways. And I pick it up and I tell folks about it. But most people are going to listen to this and just hear it. And then they won't really look at it until she does something, and then they associate that subliminal message that was imparted into their cranium, and then later it comes out. But if you know what is being done, you can actually look through things the correct way. You can actually say, they're really trying to malign her. Let's go ahead and see this, and then we'll take it on the other side.
John Kirby, the admiral of coming in from the Pentagon, this comes at a moment as the communication staff is reshaped at the West Wing. Jen Psaki, of course, just left. Corinne Jean-Pierre, the new press secretary, just started on the job this week. She had her first couple of briefings. But what Kirby brings to the White House is an expertise on foreign policy, which is something Corinne Jean-Pierre does not necessarily have. Her background is politics, domestic issues. So there's a sense that there will be a little bit of, there's no question, Corinne Jean-Pierre is the press secretary, but we'll have more of an elevated role here out of the National Security Council for John Kirby than we should, I'm told by officials, expect to hear from him at White House briefings as well, particularly on matters when it comes to the war in Ukraine and other foreign policy concerns.
How condescending. Corinne Jean-Pierre is, she's a press secretary, no doubt, she's a press secretary. But we have this other guy that he'd be able to come and explain these little political things to her. Well, guess who has more knowledge in government than Jen Psaki? Look, Jen Psaki was great. She's a great communicator. I love Jen Psaki. I think she's one of the best that ever held that office. But you know what? Corinne Jean-Pierre just started. But the other thing about Corinne Jean-Pierre is that when you look at her qualifications next to Jen Psaki's qualifications, you look and you say, okay, you have this major. Jen Psaki is an English major. And we have this person who has policy and public, meaning Corinne Jean-Pierre, public policy, government policy, etc., in her education. They never once said that about Jen Psaki. They never questioned her because you know what press secretaries do. They are briefed. They are educated on every particular issue they need to talk about. You don't have to say that person isn't experienced in foreign policy. That's not her job. But the thing about it is she is more experienced in foreign policy than is Jen Psaki. So why did he talk about Jen Psaki? He talked about Corinne Jean-Pierre. He didn't say, well, it would have been interesting if he would have said, well, you know, Corinne Jean-Pierre comes in the public sector. She's a bit more educated in that matter than Jen Psaki. But still, they're bringing another person into the fold to her in these difficult times. That's not how they framed it. They framed it as she's new, she's not as experienced, and they just went ahead and said Jen Psaki is leaving. The subliminal message is that the transition is a transition down and that she needs help. It couldn't be further from the truth, but that's what that journalist have in his head because of who it is sitting back on that press conference. This is a perfect opportunity that shouldn't go unused.
You know, one of the amazing ironies here is that the big thing they did pass, right, the American Rescue Plan, you've got this bizarre situation, right? Every Republican votes against it in the U.S. Senate. Every Democrat votes for it. It gave all this money to the states who are now using the largesse from the federal government to dole out goodies while attacking the Democrats, right? So this is the Orlando Sentinel talking about Ron DeSantis, who's going around to events, cutting checks. We're proud we didn't do like Washington and spent money like a drunken sailor when all of a sudden you ended up with all these problems, he said at a recent event in Trenton, where he doled out federally funded grants. DeSantis never mentions the largesse he's sharing comes from Washington. Instead, he attributes the money to Florida's strong economy. Democrats in this position are the worst of both worlds, which is the policy success they voted for that Republicans are opposed, local Republicans get to claim credit for.
Remember the Tea Party days? Remember what they did? They created events. Every time a Republican goes around and uses money that came from the Democrats, we should have bullhorns out there following these Republicans and letting people know the truth.
Please get one of my several books out there. As I See It, Class Warfare, the Only Resort to Right-Wing Doom, for a contribution of $120. It's worth it. How to Talk to Your Right-Wing Relatives, Friends, and Neighbors, for a contribution of $120. How to Make America Utopia, Take Away the Economy from Those Who Rigged It, for a pledge of $120. Get any two of those books for $200, any three of those books for $250. The contributions from my books go directly to support our station, KPFT 90.1 FM. Alternatively, folks, please get your basic KPFT only membership for $40, a Pacifica only membership for $25, or choose from one of our many other gifts for your contribution. Just go to kpft.org, choose Politics Done Right for the program, and select an option either for our books or something else to support the station. It is definitely worth it.
Farid Zakaria has been examining where we are in this country, the separation that's been occurring, the polarization. And in my part, the polarization is not caused by those good conservatives in the room right now. I know some of you get upset when I look at a Mike Cisak Lee Grant, or I look at who else is a conservative here? Smith, or I look at John Smith, or I look at I think I had some more conservatives in here, Eric Hayes. And like, why do you give them a break? And it's not about giving them a break. It's about your sources of information and who you trust and who you believe, right? And the one thing that I do understand is who they do, right? So I live this stuff, and not only here, but in board meetings, et cetera, how this stuff works. And they're good. Those guys who polarize us, they're good. They know what they're doing. We reward them. We reward them by really attacking or those and so forth. We have to embrace these guys. If they slap you, slap them back. If they punch you, punch them back. But at the same time, let's go ahead and understand what engagement is all about. But Farid Zakaria had a piece here that I want you guys to listen to because it's very important, and I think it's something we can learn a lot from. Check it out.
As the prospect of Roe versus Wade being overturned looms large and America braces for another round of culture wars, I've been puzzling about why clashes over values seem to be more intense in the United States than elsewhere, and why the competing camps seem more divided than before. One key to this might be found in a 2020 Pew survey showing that on many cultural issues, the American political divide was the widest among rich countries surveyed. Asked whether the country would be better off in the future if it sticks to its traditions and ways of life, 65% of Americans on the right said yes versus just 6% on the left, a 59-point gap. That compares with a 19-point gap in tradition-bound France. Asked whether being Christian was a crucial aspect of being a citizen of the country, the gap in America was 23 points compared to just 7 points in the UK. These attitudes are fleshed out further in a 2018 Pew survey, which asked people in several rich countries whether religion should play a larger role in their societies. In America, 71% of people who identified as conservative said yes, while just 29% of liberals agreed. That difference, 42 percentage points, was off the charts compared to the other countries. The gap was 17 points larger than those in the next highest countries analyzed, Canada and Poland, and roughly 4 times the gap between right and left in Sweden and Germany. In the UK, 35% of conservatives wanted religion to play a larger role in their country versus 28% of liberals, a mere 7-point gap. Many of the forces that seem to be at work, globalization, technological change, immigration, are happening in other Western societies as well. In fact, if you use the size of trade in a country's economy as a measure, America is less globalized than many European countries. It's not even special when it comes to immigration. Canada and Sweden have a larger share of foreign-born people in their societies than does the United States. And of course, technology is at work everywhere. In his last book, Religion's Sudden Decline, the distinguished social scientist Ronald Engelhardt offered an answer. Engelhardt pointed out that the most striking cultural shift of our times is the decline in religiosity in most countries. When Engelhardt and his colleague Pippa Norris analyzed survey data on attitudes toward religion from 1981 to 2007, they found that most of the countries studied had become more religious. But between 2007 and 2020, the overwhelming majority became less religious. The standout in the recent studies is the US of A. for a long time, America was the outlier in showing that rich, advanced countries can still be religious. In recent years, though, it has been reversing course to dramatic effect. Since 2007, the U.S. has been secularizing more rapidly than any other country for which we have data, notes Engelhardt. Adding, by one widely recognized criterion, it now ranks as the 12th least religious country in the world. Engelhardt explains that this process of secularization has many causes, mostly relating to the decline of group norms, of mechanisms of control, and the rise of individualism. But here's the interesting part. As this broad shift has taken place in the U.S., it is coinciding with increased polarization. So the picture that emerges is of a country that is rapidly secularizing, but at the same time seeing a strong backlash to that process. Big changes are leading to big reactions. You cannot really understand America anymore by looking at averages. It has become two countries. One is urban, more educated, multiracial, secular, and largely left of center. The other is rural, less educated, religious, white, and largely right of center. Engelhardt and the scholar Christian Welsel have a famous cultural map that plots countries according to their responses to questions about values. But if one were to divide America into two countries, one red and one blue, I suspect that you would see that blue America would fit comfortably with northern European Protestant countries, while red America's cultural values would move it closer to Nigeria and Saudi Arabia.
We think about that. Nigeria or South America, or rather Nigeria or Saudi Arabia, is what red country is starting to look like. And this is Farid Sakarya. This isn't some bleeding heart lefty. This is a guy that's right down the middle that really sees what's happening in America. He's seen how the religiosity portion of America, what they're doing to their pew, hurting them. They're seeing that, you know, if you take a look at what's occurring to those are the areas that lack that there's less education because their governors, their politicians are so evil that they don't want their people educated. They are the ones that are there making sure that their people don't get the health care, because if they get our policies that provide health care, because that means they are going to be smarter. And the last thing they want is somebody smart that is going to run the risk of changing the way things have always operated. We have to understand how these things work, folks. And Farid Sakarya, again, he is not a bleeding heart liberal. And that he points out that reality that many of us on the left have been talking about, just give that kind of a credence to what it's all about. Every time one of these incidents occur, we sit back, we say this time is going to be different, or that's how it used to be. What is sad is now I am seeing people say nothing is going to change. We can't change this. It's as if the horror has left us impotent and feeling a sense of worthlessness. And you know what? That is what's been taught for a long time, you know? But the problem is we don't have people in their particular ideologies just coming back and saying, you know, it is wrong and we are going to do what is necessary to make the change. You know, you could see that sort of resolve in Joe Scarborough's last comment. You know, he's a conservative. He left the Republican Party because of Trump. But I mean, he's a conservative who is now seemingly ready to tell folks, you know what? These guys have just now hit the limit. It is their fault why all of this is going down. I want you to listen to this, and then we'll take it on the other side.
I do my best to try to be fair to both sides, even when that's extraordinarily difficult because of the way some in my former party have conducted themselves over the past 5, 6, 7 years. But I must say, there is no splitting the difference here. There is no King Solomon splitting the baby here. This is all the Republican Party. If you want to know why those universal background checks that you support will never be voted on, it's because of the Republican Party. If you want to know why those crazy laws might be being passed in your states that allow people to carry weapons of war openly, and if Ron DeSantis has his way without a permit, without any training, it's because of the Republican Party. They're owned by the NRA. And so we keep hearing again and again and again from presidents who can't even pass legislation that 9 out of 10 Americans support.
And that is the power that we have denied ourselves. 9 out of 10 Americans want good policy that will protect American citizens, and that we have allowed, that we have disempowered ourselves by simply allowing them to fool the way we vote, for them to play with the vote. We have harmed ourselves. It does not have to be that way. Let's get busy. Let's ensure that these politicians pay the price for what they've done. Everything that has occurred in Uvalde, all that has occurred in Uvalde is on the backs of the Republicans. There is blood on their hands, and they should pay for it.
Do remember, we are in fund drive right now, but you are still getting yourself a great program that we work at putting together for you. Stuff that you, some that you may know on a small level, some that you may not know at all. That's why we're here. Politics Done Right, KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston. We're asking you to invest in this community radio station. But why? Because, folks, there's a lot of media out there, but it's not media that you control. It's not media that has your interests at hand. When we're talking about community radio, when we're talking about this community radio station, KPFT 90.1 FM, we're talking about a station that is solely funded by whom? You. And if it is funded by you, our loyalty is to you. Most other stations, commercial stations, they're funded by their advertisers, and their advertiser needs to program you. And they need to have you in a particular modal. That is why our politics is so bad. Because we need you uninformed. Politics Done Right doesn't believe in that. Politics Done Right, KPFT 90.1 FM, Pacifica Network, we don't believe that. We believe that it is essential that you are in control. It is essential that you support us so that we can feed the ethos, that we can give, we can enlighten with what is the absolute truth. In that light, I'm asking you to please call 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org and support us. You can support us with a $25 membership, a $40 membership, or you can get any one of our gifts that you find there. Please do this in the name of Politics Done Right. Also, remember that you can get one of my several books out there. As I See It, Class Warfare, The Only Resort to Right-Wing Doom, for a contribution of $120. It's Worth It, How to Talk to Your Right-Wing Relatives, Friends, and Neighbors, for a contribution of $120. How to Make America Utopia, Take Away the Economy from Those Who Rigged It, a pledge of $120. You can get any two of those books for $200, any three of those books for $250. That is to support our station. And all those books, I promise you, give you all that you need to have that conversation across the board to ensure, to help us make a better America. So please support us.
please support KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. Call 713-526-5738 or visit kpft.org. In the name of Politics Done Right, please select one of our books, several of our books, or one of our offers. We're here for you. You can get Politics Done Right Mondays through Fridays on Facebook Live at facebook.com/politicsdoneright, on YouTube Live at politicsdoneright.com/YouTube. Please do not forget to follow me on Twitter for updates. My handle is at Egberto Willis, at EGBERTOWILLIES. Before you get started, please remember to keep your community radio station in your minds, KPFT in your minds. Talk about it. Tell your friends about it. Tell them you know about this station in town, 90.1 FM Houston, that needs your support, that is there to provide what that nourishment that we need. 713-526-5738. KPFT.org. Visit us online. Contribute online. KPFT 90.1 FM. You can visit us at kpft.org.
Welcome to one more edition of Politics and Right. I'm Egberto Willis, your host. Today, we are honored to have John Marshall. Who is John Marshall? John Marshall is an associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism, Media Integrated Marketing and Communications at Northwestern University. He is the author of Watergate's Legacy and the Press, The Investigative Impulse. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Atlantic.com, everybody here watches that, listens, I mean, reads that, WashingtonPost.com, Christian Center Monitor, Princess Science Monitor, CBS News, Public Eye, Chicago Tribune, Huffington Post, and many other venues. It is my honor to have you, Dr. Marshall. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Egberto. How are you today?
I am doing great. But I tell you what, normally when I start these interviews, I don't start with a book that you write. But it so happened that this book that you wrote, I think just the title alone is something that it's something that we have to take into account right now. So why don't you tell us a little bit about why you wrote the book and the tenets that you brought out in the book?
Sure. I started on the book back in 2017, soon after Donald Trump was elected president. And we all saw and heard a president who vehemently and consistently attacked journalists, used violent imagery to describe journalists, applauded when a congressional candidate body slammed a journalist, and called journalists enemies of the American people. I wanted to understand how we got to that point in terms of the relationship between presidents and the press, and whether what Donald Trump was doing was completely unprecedented, or were there some precedents for what he was doing, and what were the forces that led to this point.
Now, let me ask you this, because you said whether it was unprecedented or not, or whether it was sort of delivered through some sort of externality, the other forces that came out there. What was your thought on that? Was it unprecedented or not?
Well, there are parts of it, what I found from my research, some of it was precedented, some of it wasn't unprecedented. So what was precedented? First, the kind of intense partisanship in the media. We've had that before, particularly in the early years of this country, in the 1790s, early 1800s. I write about John Adams's presidency, and things were just as nasty then as they are now.
Really?
They were, yes. The level of insults, the level, level of criticism. One thing that was fascinating is the kind of rhetoric around immigration was very similar. That immigrants were bringing in crime, were bringing in disease, were going to be disloyal. They talked about immigrants in the same way in the 1790s, except they were talking about the French,
Irish,
the Germans, yeah, and the Irish.
Right.
Different nationalities, same rhetoric. What was also precedented is, you know, Donald Trump was famous for using Twitter as a way to reach his base, to try to motivate his voters. But he was far from the only president to use a new technology to try to go beyond the White House press corps and speak to the public directly. Franklin Roosevelt famously did that with radio
and right,
fireside chats. He got around the publishers. Many publishers hated Franklin Roosevelt, but he got around them through new technology. John F. Kennedy and other presidents used television. and then starting with Obama, and then definitely Donald Trump using social media to do that. So that part was precedented too. Also precedented was Richard Nixon was the first to really come up with the strategy of casting journalists as an enemy. As an enemy that the public should distrust.
Wait, let me back up and ask you. You said yeah. Nixon was the first one who actually made the press the enemy, not these others.
Right. I mean, every president has complained about the press, has been upset about things in the press, occasionally lashed out at the press. I think they've all done that. But for Nixon, it was a definite strategy. There's in his archives, you can see memos that his chief of staff wrote to him saying, we can make the press a useful enemy. And Nixon wrote, we need to discredit the media. We need to discredit it. So it was a focused strategy that he had. In the end, it didn't work for Nixon. He was forced to resign because of Watergate. But Trump picked up that strategy and then kind of put it on steroids in terms of casting the press as an enemy. So those are things I think were precedented. Some things that were unprecedented about Trump. Every president at least paid some lip service to the idea that a free press is important in the United States.
Right.
The First Amendment is something important. Even if they really disliked journalists, they would still say, we need the First Amendment. We need a free press. Trump, nah, no, just the opposite. And Trump was really the first to use violent language about journalists. And the first to make spreading conspiracy theories at the heart of his presidency as part of his media strategy. So I think there were parts of the Trump presidency that was unprecedented. And then there were parts that we've seen in the past in history.
Okay. I want to expand the discussion a bit because my concern here is it is horrendous that Donald Trump made the press the enemy, that Donald Trump attacked the press, that Donald Trump actually put many of the press in danger. However, my question to you with regards to the press has to do now with the accuracy of the press. And isn't it true that to some extent they've laid the groundwork for, if you will, part of the demise of the stature that they would normally have? As an example, Donald Trump, in my humble opinion, would not have become president in the beginning if some of the most ridiculous things he spoke about were treated as such by a press who actually gave it legs. In other words, when we spoke about, let me give one good example, and then I'd like a response. Remember that we had Obama was considered, he was illegitimate because he was born somewhere else. Now, we all know that McCain was born in the country of my birth, Panama, okay? Now, Obama was born of an American mother. Even if you thought he was born in Kenya, it would not have mattered. Obama could be president because just like McCain was a natural born citizen because he was of an American mother, so would have Obama had been even if born in Kenya. Yet not any, there's no American that would know that if he's born in Kenya, he was still a legitimate president.
Oh, you're absolutely right about that part. So two-part response to what you say. Yes, journalists, the press, the media makes a lot of mistakes. Everything the media does is by definition public. We see it all, we hear it all,
right.
We read it all. Unlike most other professions, you make a mistake, you're not necessarily going to get caught in it. Mm-hmm. Journalists get caught and deservedly so. So I'm not going to just say that the press is always perfect about it. And I think the example you give is a great example of when they did a very bad job. And I write about this in the book quite a bit, that Trump spread this lie. It was a lie. It was a false conspiracy that Obama wasn't really a true American, even though his birth certificate proved he was born in Hawaii. There were newspaper announcements, you know, a birth announcement when he was born in the Honolulu newspaper. But yet Trump was able to spread this conspiracy, not just on Fox News, where he went regularly to push it, but on some of the, you know, so-called mainstream TV stations. He would go on like Good Morning America and spread it. He's clever about it in that he would say, well, we need to ask the question. Or some people are saying, which is a kind of a classical conspiracy theory thing. Well, some people are saying this, so I'm going to talk about it. even though it's demonstrably untrue. And particularly the TV shows he went on did not call him on it, and they continued to have him on their shows because he was good ratings. So they were going for the dollars. They were going for the profits. Trump was famous. They would have him on. He would say these ridiculous conspiracy theories. And sometimes they push back on it, but usually not. And they let him get away with it. And he rode that to the White House.
Now, Dr. Marshall, with staying on that same subject with the Obama thing, is it the responsibility of the press to go the next step? In other words, you point out the fact that you stated that, yes, we could find his birth certificate. Yes, we could find all that information. But the fact that he was born of an American mother made whether he was born in Kenya or not moot. It made it a moot point. But the press didn't go that extra step to say, even if should they do that. And I can bring some other examples as we look at inflation today and how prices have gone up. Did they say that? But we're starting from a negative position. In other words, during the pandemic, we started from a negative position, and thus the absolute growth looks like inflation is more than it is. Things like that concerns me that it has political effects on our system, but it's not accurate reporting that does it. So, Mike, your answer.
So I do think some of the press did point out the fact that you did about his mother, but I think it got buried in the stories and didn't get enough attention. So I'm going to mostly agree with you about that. Mm-hmm. And I think what your point about inflation is, I think one bias a lot of the media has, a lot of the press has, is toward the negative, towards conflict. The press tends to look for conflict because that's more dramatic. Mm-hmm. So there's more drama to talk about the problems with inflation, which are very real. Less drama to talk about, wages have gone up. Unemployment has gone way down. The deficit is going down. So there's a focus on the bad news rather than the good parts of what's going on. I think the press does a bad job of sometimes getting the complexity of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I think they also focus on the whole, not all reporters, but a lot of them focus a lot on sort of the horse race aspect of politics.
Right.
Which candidate's up, which candidate's down.
Right.
How is this policy going to affect the midterm elections? Or how is this mm-hmm. policy going to affect Joe Biden winning or not winning in 2024? Rather than what does this policy mean for different Americans or different people around the world? What are the advantages of this policy, disadvantages? What are some of the complexities of it? There's some of that reporting, but I think it tends to get drowned out by the drama of that political horse race reporting.
Now, based on your research, because empirically I can say certain things, but I imagine you've done some studies. How influential is the press, and how much has the press changed what would have otherwise occurred?
No, that's a great question. There are studies about how the press has the ability to kind of set the agenda mm-hmm. in terms of what issues people talk about. And it also has the power to frame the issue, to kind of what we were just talking about, what to include in the story, what to leave out of the story. There were some studies done that after birth of Fox News, the people who listened to Fox News were several percentage points more likely to vote Republican than before they had listened to Fox News, as one example mm-hmm. of how press or the media can sway people politically. So it's going to depend a little bit from outlet to outlet in terms of how much difference it makes, and it probably varies from person to person. But on the whole, how the press, what stories the press covers, and then again how they frame it does indeed make a difference, as you suggest.
Now, I remember being in Washington, D.C. in the old days during a Tea Party protest, and we came with Build a Dream, and we had several thousand people that came to Build the Dream, right? And we had about, maybe a few dozen Tea Partiers. And when we saw the news that day, we had a slight mention of Barber. And it was as if Washington was controlled by the Tea Party in those days. How much responsibility should the press take for issues like that?
That's another really good example. I write about in the book how the Tea Party was really an offshoot of Fox News, mm-hmm. an offshoot of a lot of talk radio show hosts. The Tea Party was really kind of nothing at the start. It was one guy on a rant. The Fox,
I remember that on Fox,
promoted yeah. it, and Fox News personalities would lead Tea Party rallies. And the same with some of the conservative talk radio hosts as well. So that was a case where at least some elements of the press were pushing this ideological position. And I think the rest of the press, a lot of the rest of the press is sort of guilty of sort of responding to that and saying, oh, we've got to cover that equally to what Obama is doing. So we're going to give the Tea Party equal coverage. And I'm one who you're just saying that Reverend Barber, as mm-hmm. I understand it,
yes, you know, it was
rally the same day. I admit that I was unfamiliar with that. So mm-hmm. that's a good case where the coverage of what he was doing did not get equal time.
Well, it's interesting because he has a group called the Poor Man's Campaign, and it's a great multicultural group. It looks like America, and they are out there doing a lot of things throughout the country. And they are ones that are really supporting a large, as you know, what the stats tells us about America right now. They're actually supporting what a majority of the population wants. And I'll be darned, I don't see them in the news. So my next question is how much, you know, I understand that it's wrong for a lot of folks to deal with the media the way they deal. That's why we have independent media. But I mean, it is kind of interesting that we don't see the coverage of things that matter to, let's say, 70% of the population. And if you look at you go to a White House news conference, and I listen to them every day, and you go to a White House news conference, it doesn't cover 90% of the things that really is. References the everyday person.
Yeah. I think on the whole, the press does not do a good job of covering poverty and issues for working class people. One of the things that happened during the first year of the Biden administration is that the child poverty went down mm-hmm. significantly. Yes. Went down.
Yes.
We didn't hear a lot about that. We heard a lot more about corporate tax cuts and so forth. One of the suggestions I have in the last chapter of my book of Clash, where I make some recommendations for the future, is that I think the White House press corps needs to circulate more, mm-hmm. not just stay inside Washington, but spend time.
Doctor, let me stop you there because yeah. that is how I really want to end with solutions, because I think that is exactly what we need. So before you get into solutions, sorry for interrupting there. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you about, do you see any backstories for the reasons why things that matter, let's say like environment, which is a very in what's the word that I want to use? Whatever, it's very important right now for our survival, doesn't have the coverage relative to its importance to society at large.
So why is that the case?
I have a contention that we have too much, that the media is a part of this capitalist system, if you will. And as such, it also depends on the same corporations that it may have to speak out against. Is there any validity to that?
I think there's some validity to that. Mm-hmm. A large portion of the media is controlled by large corporations. And I think there may be instances when reporters are pressured not to cover something. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, I've worked in a lot of newsrooms. And I know that every reporter I worked with was most interested in getting a good story mm-hmm. And finding out what was going on. Not that we were perfect about it. Mm-hmm. And I never had a case where an editor or a publisher told me not to do a story. I think part of it is climate change is reported on. It's out there, but I think it's also it's complicated, and it's easier to tell those kind of short horse race stories than it is to try to explain what's going on with climate change. And I think it gets into what we talked a little bit about earlier. Climate change most affects people living in poorer countries mm-hmm. right now. And I think we have very weak global coverage. And in the United States, the people who are most affected by and large are people who live in less advantaged communities. Those are the people who get hammered the most when there's a hurricane or when there's mm-hmm. flooding or when there's fires and droughts. It tends to be those neighborhoods. So I think it's back to a little bit to too many journalists coming from the middle or wealthier classes and not paying attention to people who are living in poverty or people who are barely making it in the economy.
Is there any possibility of some self-censorship as well, knowing who pays the bills?
I think there's some possibility of that. I think there's some examples of that. But again, my experience is that what journalists are most interested in is beating their competition and getting a story. We're very competitive. Yeah. I once punched a hole in a wall when the competitor
somebody gets it before you, right?
A story that I should have had. We want to beat the competition. So part of it, there is kind of a groupthink, I think. Like if your competitors are covering one thing, then you're going to try to outdo them on that one thing. And you see that, I think, in Washington all the time. They get focused on one story. Don't think about the broader picture.
All right, let's end it this way. I have, and it ends with two questions. First of all, please give me some solutions, number one. And I'm going to tag this one along because I don't want to kind of put it on the side. Tell me what you would have liked me to ask you that I didn't. And if you see any one of my interviews, that's always my last questions, my brother.
Okay. You know, that's great. That's usually my last question when I'm out reporting too.
So all right.
Great. I love it. So I do suggest several solutions in my book. One, I think, gets at some of the things that you've been bringing up is more support for nonprofit journalism. There are some excellent examples of nonprofit journalism around the country, but it's not as big of a sector as the for-profit journalism. Mm-hmm. ProPublica is probably the best investigative reporting site out there now. They're a nonprofit. There's a number of sort of traditional established newspapers that have switched to nonprofit status in my own city, Chicago. The Chicago Sun-Times is now allied with the local public radio station and has gotten nonprofit status. But as I understand it, the tax laws are really difficult to navigate to do that. It's really complicated. And they don't make it easy to become a nonprofit. So I think that's something that could be done to make that easier. I think a huge part of the revenue that comes from digital advertising goes mm-hmm. to two places, Facebook and Google. Last stat I saw was three-fifths of the digital advertising dollars are going to those two companies.
Wow.
Australia passed a law that when Facebook or Google or any other social media company uses news content that somebody else created, and that's what they do. You know, the people will post the news from elsewhere and then people see it on Facebook. Facebook sells ads from that. So Australia has a law that if Facebook or any other company uses news that someone else created, guess what? They have to pay for it. There has to be a fee that goes to the people who did the reporting to get that information. And I think if there's additional revenue for reporting, we're going to get deeper and more diverse story as a result. So those are two of the suggestions I would have. I've got many
a ton more. Folks, to get the rest of his suggestions, go get the book, which is going to be along with the blog. And you can just do it as you listen to the show as well. Continue, my friend.
And then I think a question I wish you'd ask me is what can we all as citizens, as voters, as members of the public, as consumers of media do? I think we all have a responsibility to become savvier about what we're consuming, understand how social media algorithms work, to try to push and promote the most incendiary content, most controversial content, rather than necessarily the most factual content. There's a stat in my book that in the April of 2020, the first big month of COVID, that sites from the 10 leading health websites got 70 million views. Sites from the 10 leading conspiracy sites about COVID got 300 million, four times as many. So we need to become smarter about how that works. And I think that media kind of media literacy needs to be taught in the schools. I think media literacy is a basic skill now, like algebra or poetry. Media saturates our lives. We're bombarded with it, and we need to understand how to sort through what's propaganda and what's real information, what's verified information, what's not verified, how advertisers are trying to work us, manipulate us, how those algorithms work, and just really understand what it is that we're consuming, so we can be able to sort through the disinformation and get to the facts.
Dr. John Marshall, Associate Professor at the Medill School of Journalism and the author of Clash, Presidents and the Press in Times of Crisis. Thank you so kindly for having been on Politics Done Right.
Thank you, Berto. Thank you very much for having me.
Please get one of my several books out there. As I See It, Class Warfare, The Only Resort to Right-Wing Doom, for a contribution of $120. It's Worth It, How to Talk to Your Right-Wing Relatives, Friends, and Neighbors, for a contribution of $120. How to Make America Utopia, Take Away the Economy from Those Who Rigged It, for a pledge of $120. Get any two of those books for $200, any three of those books for $250. The contributions for my books go directly to support our station, KPFT 90.1 FM. Alternatively, folks, please get your basic KPFT-only membership for $40, a Pacifica-only membership for $25, or choose from one of our many other gifts for your contribution. Just go to kpft.org, choose Politics Done Right for the program, and select an option either for our books or something else to support the station. It is definitely worth it. You can listen and or watch Politics Done Right Mondays through Fridays on Facebook Live at facebook.com/politicsdoneright or on YouTube Live at politicsdoneright.com/YouTube. Please do not forget to follow me on Twitter for updates. My Twitter handle is at Egberto Willis, at EGBERTOWILLIS. But don't you forget, listen to us live on air at KPFT 90.1 FM on Thursdays at noon and at Fridays at 11 a.m. all Central Time. Please remember to keep your community radio station in your minds. Keep KPFT on your mind. Talk about it. Tell your friends about it. Tell them you know about this station in town, 90.1 FM Houston, that needs your support. That is there to provide that nourishment that we need. KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. Well, folks, that's it for today. You know how I'm going to end this baby. My name is Egberto Willis. This is Politics Done Right. And you know how I end this baby. I am what? Out.
Welcome to Politics Done Right. I am your host, Egberto Willis. This is a progressive program that will take the mystery out of politics. This is the program that will encourage you to make sure government becomes we the people. Whether you are liberal, progressive, conservative, or otherwise, you get to hear your point of view. We are an independent media outlet that, unlike mainstream media beholden to corporations, we only owe allegiance to you. Remember, you can also send me a tweet at EGBERTOWILLIS. That is at Egberto Willis. Let us engage.